This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
So we're going to start out close to home this week. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo recently toured the state promoting his legislative plans for the new year. He spent a lot of that time talking about education, and leaders around the state noticed.
What we did most applaud would be the fact that he promises a record level of education funding, and we certainly hope that that funding comes through and it's distributed equitably.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear reaction to education policy changes in the Empire State. Then it's off to the UK to hear how scientists are trying to repair defects in DNA with gene splicing. And we'll spend an academic minute learning fertility from a fruit fly. I'm Bob Barry, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo recently wrapped up a regional State of the State tour during which he outlined his legislative agenda for 2017. Education policy was a big part of that tour. For more on what the governor had to say about the future of education in the Empire State, The Best of Our Knowledge's Brian Shields spoke with Tim Creamer, the executive director of the New York State School Boards Association.
After-school programs, an expansion of that. He would propose a $35 million pilot program that would add 22,000 after-school slots for students who are in poorer districts throughout the state. He also proposed excellence in teaching grants that would be given to honor teachers who have done some extraordinary work. He offered up the idea of having a couple recovery high schools that are aimed at helping students recover from addictions, one upstate, one downstate. What we did most applaud would be the fact that he promises a record level of education funding, and we certainly hope that that funding comes through and it's distributed equitably and in a way that meets the needs.
This is not exactly in your jurisdiction. You handle secondary and elementary education, but any thoughts on his plan for free tuition at the SUNY and CUNY schools?
Well, what we've said publicly, we think this is a something worth applauding, but we, of course, do represent those children who are in that developmental stage of pre-K through 12th grade, and that foundation has to be solid. We don't want to see this program of free tuition made available at the expense of pre-K through 12. Those children who go to the schools that I represent, they have to be prepared for college. It doesn't do enough to just write them a check. They got to be prepared to actually enroll and do well. Moreover, not every kid is going on to college. So those children also have to be attended to in the stage before college.
The governor is also calling on county executives to come up with plans to consolidate, to save money with neighboring localities. Are you feeling this in the local school districts as well? Is there a push for you to consolidate, for you to merge and do things together to maybe lower taxes?
Kind of comes and goes. Obviously, the property tax cap has had an amazing impact on our ability to raise money locally. It has caused us, I suspect, to look for efficiencies, and some of that would be to collaborate with others. This particular proposal that he has now for property tax reduction, interestingly enough, excluded school districts. We've been included in the past, and we've worked with counties and municipalities on programs that have had us revenue or resource sharing, but this particular one did not include school districts.
The county executives often complain that they'd love to consolidate, they'd love to save money, but so much of their budget, so much of their spending is state mandated. Is that also the case for school districts across the state, that so much of what goes into that budget has to be there because the state says so?
Absolutely. It's either happening at Washington or happening in Albany, where we are told daily, here is something else you need to do, a new report, a new requirement, a new program that is necessary for you to implement. And oftentimes they don't come with additional resources. So we are doing more with less, indeed, and we're trying our best to make it work. There certainly are efficiencies that can be had. We're working on that. And yet we do find ourselves oftentimes under the thumb of the state telling us what to do without giving us additional resources.
The final state aid numbers probably won't be known until the budget is delivered and signed. What are you hoping for when it comes to state aid?
Well, we put forward a number that's of $2 billion in additional state aid, and we made known that we feel that $1.4 billion of that should be made available in what we call foundation aid. That's aid that's distributed. It's kind of operating aid that's distributed in a way where the people who need it most get the most. And we would suggest that that foundation aid formula be phased in over 3 years. It's something that we've been behind on for the last 10 years, and we're trying to get it back up to where it belongs. But we put together a formula that said foundation aid plus new investments plus expense-based aids that are all money already owed to us. It totals up to about $2 billion.
He hasn't taken office yet, but any thoughts on the Trump administration and what it could mean for education at the state and local level?
Well, of course, the thing that most we're watching most closely is the fact that he has nominated a woman named Betsy DeVos as his proposed Secretary of Education, and that is somebody who has no background in public education at all. And in fact, we're very concerned that she would want to abandon much of public education in favor of charter schools, voucher programs, and other private choice initiatives.
The governor mentioned earlier about the recovery high schools. There's been so much talk about the opiate epidemic. How is this affecting the schools at all levels?
Well, this is just tragic, and it's such a sign of the times. When you read the statistics about the number of young people who are overdosing, it's just heartbreaking. I just read this morning that there is a program in which every school district could participate that would allow them to administer Narcan, a anecdote to an overdose, and yet there's only 55 school districts that have signed up for this so far. And I was surprised at that. I'm going to guess that more districts are going to sign up because they do realize this could happen here. We've seen it happen, and it is something that is a real tragedy that is occurring in our schools today.
Tim Creamer is the executive director of the New York State School Boards Association. One area that Brian touched on in his conversation with Tim Creamer was the governor's recent proposal to provide free college tuition to state or city universities or community colleges. The proposal has drawn a good deal of attention from those inside and outside the state's academic circles. Under the plan, free tuition would be available to New Yorkers whose families make under $125,000 a year. But what could that mean for private, independent colleges? To get that point of view, Brian Shields spoke with Dr. Carolyn Stefanko, president of the College of St. Rose in Albany.
Certainly, we support the governor's efforts because we all want to make college affordable and we all want to create an opportunity for all New Yorkers to access higher education. What I believe is that the proposal could be enlarged so that it would be possible for students and their families, if their families are involved in the decisions, to have the opportunity to attend an independent institution of higher education in New York.
Could this draw applicants away from St. Rose and other colleges if they know I can go to a SUNY school for free? Why should I pay tuition at St. Rose or any other place?
Well, I think it certainly could, and I think that there would I think higher education would be hurt, and I think students would be hurt, because I do believe that American higher education is the envy of the world because of the fact that we are so diverse. And we know that our students are diverse. They have all kinds of needs in terms of who they are, what age they are, the kind of program they want to study, whether it's good for them to live at home or travel some distance to experience a different kind of environment as part of their college education. And I'm very much in favor of protecting that choice. So what I would prefer is if a program that has long been supported by the state of New York, TAP, right, the Tuition Assistance Program, if more money would be funneled into that, because that's a model whereby the students and their families, as I said, if their families are included, can still have the power of making the decision about which, in that diverse landscape, educational institution is best for them.
We hear so much about student debt coming from student loans from college students who are graduating. They sometimes have $50, $100, maybe even more than $100,000 to pay off when they get their diploma. What, if anything, is being done at the state and national levels that could help this problem, and what do you think should be done?
Well, I think that everyone is very concerned about affordability and all institutions of higher education. Now, I've been in the public side as well as the independent or private side, and we're all working very hard to keep costs of education as low as they can be, because we're in education because we're committed to providing that transformational experience, not just for the individual, but in many cases the individual's families. So there's no question that we're all concerned about that. We're also, though, equally concerned with correcting some of the national conversation about this, because you're right, we all talk about these outliers, really, these students who have, you know, $200,000 in debt by the time they graduate, and it's just not the norm. I mean, those averages really draw quite strongly from students who attend graduate school, and especially professional schools, law school, medical school, which are very, you know, expensive. We know on the independent side nationally that the average debt for a student who attends an independent institution of higher education is about $30,000.
Would St. Rose perhaps have to change its curricula to reflect a need to attract students who are not going to take advantage of this free tuition? Might you have to change what you're all about, perhaps, as your mission?
I don't think so. And that's actually not within my purview anyway. The curriculum is really largely the responsibility of the faculty. I mean, certainly we have to partner with the faculty in a shared governance environment to make sure that we're offering degrees that will support students on their life journeys, and that those degrees reflect, you know, 20th century thinking and are up to date and what have you. But independent higher education in New York is as committed as public higher education in New York to economic development and to student success and to, you know, in our case of St. Rose, the success of the Capital Region, but ultimately the success of the state of New York and of our country.
Dr. Carolyn Stefanko is the president of the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Brian Shields. Still to come, scientists in the UK are using gene splicing to edit DNA. That's next on the best of our knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Last year, in a landmark decision, the UK's Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority gave researchers approval to conduct gene editing experiments on human embryos. Human gene editing allows scientists to delete, repair, or replace bits of cell DNA in a biological form of cut and paste. Scientists will not be creating babies with the modified embryos. They'll be destroyed after 7 days. The goal is to better understand human development in a bid to improve fertility treatments and prevent miscarriages. On the program Digital Europe, DW Radio's Jesse Wingard spoke with Harvard Medical School professor and director of the Stem Cell Transplantation Program at Boston Children's Hospital, George Daly, about the ins and outs of human gene editing.
Professor, there's no denying gene editing is rather controversial. Did the potential benefits of what we can learn from this research outweigh the fears that some people might have?
The controversial aspects of this work really pertain to changing genes in babies in the context of in vitro fertilization. What has been approved in the UK is purely laboratory-based fundamental inquiries about the nature of early human embryo development. This is incredibly important work. It's going to teach us about infertility, potentially about the basis of miscarriage, and the understanding of the earliest stages of human development may also teach us about birth defects. So the work is fundamentally important. And I think that we can distinguish work that stays in the laboratory from the thornier issue of using this technology to actually change traits in human individuals. That's something that I, as a member of a large group of scientists, have called for restraint, really to allow us to understand much more about the safety issues involved, but even more importantly, to participate in a public debate so that we can achieve societal consensus about what, if any, might be permissible uses versus those we want to restrict.
So if we move away from designer babies and focus on people who are already alive, can such gene editing research be used to cure existing illnesses?
There's tremendous promise for using this very powerful technology of gene editing in somatic tissues, body tissues, not involving babies and birthing through IVF and not involving the germline. For instance, in various blood diseases, let's talk about sickle cell anemia. It's a very devastating, painful condition of abnormal red blood cells. There is a strategy where you can use this technique to alter a single, very small part of the blood cell's genes, and it would essentially, at least we predict, alleviate the devastating consequences of sickle cell anemia. There are other applications that scientists are envisioning for rendering blood cells resistant to HIV, treating cells in the retina for reversing blindness, and really the opportunities are really vast in human medicine.
How will this kind of technology then assist HIV/AIDS research?
Well, the most specific application has to do with a fascinating observation made a number of years ago, that certain individuals that carry a particular gene variant in a receptor for the virus, that is sort of the docking site on the cell for the virus, these individuals are resistant to HIV. Now, they seem to be healthy in virtually every other manner, and the strategy for using gene editing would be to clip this receptor, delete this receptor protein in healthy cells and make them resistant to infection by the virus. So this is a strategy that may be able to be used therapeutically in individuals who are already infected, that's being tested. But more importantly, it may in fact be able to be used as a kind of an intracellular immunization or a quasi-vaccine approach to prevent HIV. So there's really some very exciting possibilities for treating and preventing HIV using this technology.
Some people say gene editing is messing up the genetic makeup of embryos. What can scientists do then to convince people of its benefits?
Well, scientists have to first do the hard work. They have to really do the painstaking research that would prove, in fact, that we can, with great precision and at reasonable safety, actually alter genes, ideally genes involved in human disease, and really prove the value. I think that will be done first clinically in somatic tissues, perhaps in the context of a bone marrow transplant or a gene therapy for a blood disease. And then in the longer term, it's really not up to the scientist to decide how it gets used, if it's ever to be used in changing actual human traits, changing traits in the germline. That's a decision that would have to engage a much, much broader range of stakeholders. And that's a process that I don't think we're anywhere near down the road on. We're just starting to think about that process in meetings like we've held in Washington in December of last year.
Is it going to take then a Nobel Prize for human gene editing for it to become mainstream and acceptable?
It's already mainstream. I mean, everyone anticipates that this technology will be awarded a Nobel Prize. It's going to be rather difficult to figure out the many people who've made major contributions because the Nobel can award only to three. But this has already been absorbed into most major molecular biology labs across the world. It is such a powerful technique, so easily applied, and that it's just really taken the scientific community by storm. And that means it's going to find its way into cancer research, infectious disease research, and there are many other applications outside of biomedicine. You may have already heard that There are strategies for altering plants to make them resistant to disease, strategies for altering mosquitoes so that they can no longer be a vector for malaria or perhaps the Zika virus. So the impacts for biomedicine are great, but the impacts for kind of global agriculture and the ecosystem are also both promising and challenging and require very, very thoughtful review before they're launched.
I was speaking there with Harvard Medical School professor and the director of the Stem Cell Transplantation Program at Boston Children's Hospital, George Daly, about the potential for gene editing.
And that report from DW Radio's Jesse Wingard from the program Digital Europe. Gene editing may tell us a lot about human reproduction and development, or, you know, we could just ask a fruit fly. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
What can fruit flies tell us about ourselves? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Prashant Rangan, associate professor of biological sciences at the University of Albany, delves into this question.
It is well known that a human is born with thousands of immature eggs in her ovaries, each of which can sit in a hibernation-like state for several decades. But until now, it is not well understood what triggers these eggs to wake up from the resting to then mature properly. Waking up of these eggs is critical for female fertility. Genetically, fruit flies and humans are surprisingly alike. This includes their reproductive process. Our research team decided to conduct a series of experiments using these insects to determine how their eggs prepare for ovulation. Fruit fly eggs also have a hibernation-like resting period, and using these flies, we found that there is a conserved protein, KDM5, that instructs the developing eggs to wake up and mature for ovulation. My graduate student assistant, Alicia McCarthy, and I compared the activity of this protein to an alarm clock. If the fruit fly was deficient in KDM5, the alarm clock does not sound at the correct time. As a consequence, the egg would not wake up at the right time, and this would lead to fertility issues. And while our findings, conducted along with several researchers, including Paolo Navarro and Hui Martinho at the University of Algarve and Instituto Gulbenkian de Ciência in Portugal, are still a work in progress, we believe that this conserved protein can give us further insight into the role of alarm clocks in egg development. And ultimately, this may be able to help in better understanding of human fertility issues.
That was Prashant Rangan of the University at Albany. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.